right now, we're looking at a wave election for 2018, and the question is going to be, is it going to be a little wave, or is it going to be a tsunami? And that's what we're trying to create, is a tsunami, which could mean that we flip districts that Republicans on paper have an advantage of that's insurmountable.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. Charles Chamberlain is a longtime political activist who is the executive director of Democracy for America, an important progressive political action committee. DFA was founded in 2004 by former Democratic presidential candidate and chairman of the Democratic National Committee, Howard Dean. DFA leads public awareness campaigns, trains activists, and provides funding directly to candidates for office. The organization has more than 1 million members in the United States and internationally. When you talk to Charles, you hear his commitment to Dean's notion that progressives should be fighting everywhere in the country and representing the activist wing of the party. We had a very good conversation. So first, our sponsor, and then my interview with Charles Chamberlain and DFA.
Check out the large, detailed, and high-quality political data graphic posters from TimePlots. Our visual history of the American presidency, for example, lets you see the Clinton, Bush, Obama, and Trump presidencies in full context. TimePlots library includes visual histories of the United States House, the United States Senate, the Supreme Court, and the Democratic and Republican parties. Find them all at www.timeplots.com. Use the code BATTLEFIELD for a discount.
I'm Charles Chamberlain. I'm the Executive Director of Democracy for America. I've been doing this work for over 20 years. I started in California working in the initiative process. That's direct democracy, where you qualify an initiative by gathering signatures and then you work to try to pass it. I started that way and then continue to move forward in grassroots politics, working on campaign for an assembly member in California, LA city council member eventually, and then moving out of California and working in Oregon and all over the country. I've actually lived in 20 states for 3 months or more over the course of my political career. Back in 2006, I joined the team at Democracy for America up in our headquarters in Burlington, Vermont. And I joined the team as the political director and worked my way up. And eventually, I'm now the executive director of the organization. And I currently live in Reno, Nevada.
So what is Democracy for America?
That's a great question. Democracy for America is an organization that has been around for 14 years. We were founded on the principle that Democrats should be fighting, or progressives rather, should be fighting everywhere so that we can win everywhere. A 50-state strategy of making sure that we leave no stone unturned. So what that means is to fight everywhere, we need to mobilize and create a community of activists across this country. And that's what we've done through action on issues, through training, through our campaign academies, both online and offline. And of course, through our support of candidates at all level of office, from the school board all the way to the presidency.
Now, my understanding is that Democracy of America was sort of the continuation of the Dean campaign for president in 2003-04. Is that right?
You know, I'm not sure I would say continuation so much as the evolution. After Howard Dean finished running for president, he wasn't done trying to change America. And so what he did, along with the millions of grassroots supporters that were helping to push his campaign, is that we all decided we wanted to continue to organize together as a community to make change happen. So even during that general election, Governor Dean founded Democracy for America as an organization focused on a 50-state strategy of electing candidates up and down the ballot across the whole country. But that, of course, also included trying to elect John Kerry in 2004. You know, the first thing that we started working on was trying to win the presidential race, along with winning key races around the country, which I don't want to hesitate to point out. We supported Barack Obama as one of the very first Dean dozen candidates in his campaign for Senate in Illinois. We've also supported some other superstars early on that have gone on to be huge successes. So we have a fantastic track record that way of often being ahead of the curve and supporting the great Democratic leaders of the future, progressives, often because we get in so early at their state and local level.
Where do you think you fit into the progressive ecosystem? Where do you fit in ideologically and as an organization?
Yeah, you know, we're an interesting mix. And we've been around long enough and have enough connections to the establishment through Governor Dean, who our first campaign after the 2004 election was to elect Governor Dean to be the chair of the DNC. That's the Democratic National Committee. And the goal there was that we were asking Howard to reorganize the Democratic Party from the top down. And we asked our members to reorganize the party from the bottom up. And the idea is they would meet together in the middle and transforming a party that was formerly focused entirely on just swing states and pushing a 50-state strategy across the entire country. And in fact, that's what we did. It succeeded. In 2006, we had an incredible landslide victories in the House and Senate. And that was largely because of the fact that we had a Democratic Party that was investing in states everywhere. I mean, we wouldn't have won Alaska, for example, with Mark Begich had there not been infrastructure in place that was put there through the 50-state strategy that Governor Dean was pushing.
How would you size the organization? What does it have for staff and what does it have for members and finances? Tell me a little about that.
Sure. You know, actually, I realized that in the previous question, I only talked about sort of the establishment side of what we're doing in the regards to the fact that we jumped on trying to reform the Democratic Party on a national level. But I guess what I should point out before I move on to the other aspect is that that role has meant that we're often fighting with the Democratic Party itself, which means that we have both sort of this establishment role, but we also have a very much an outsider role. And I think that one of the greatest examples of that is that because we're member driven, we polled our membership before we made an endorsement in 2016. We didn't just make an insider decision to support one candidate or another. And by doing that, our members universally came back and said, 89% of our members, in fact, in a poll that over 150,000 people voted in, said they wanted to see us endorse Bernie Sanders. So I think that does a good job of showing both how, you know, we're connected to the establishment and also at the same time, we're the outsiders that constantly push the Democratic Party to move forward. So getting to your second question, how big are we? Well, we're an organization that leverages about $10 million a cycle. About $8 million of that supports directly the funding of Democracy for America and the direct work that we do on campaigns. And about $2 million of that is what we tend to directly organize financially and resources to the campaigns. Now, that obviously changes a little bit year to year. Our biggest years are always presidential years, and our smallest years are the years immediately following a presidential year. As far as the size of an organization, we're pretty small and scrappy. We have 24 staff, and we have over 1 million members nationwide. So 24 staff that are trying to empower an incredible grassroots base of volunteers that can do effective action. So I mentioned already some of the money we leverage, but what I didn't mention is the incredible amount of actual grassroots on the ground support. And that includes making phone calls directly to voters, voter contact that is almost always coordinated with the campaign. So that information that we gather over the phone gets shared with the campaign and they're able to use it in their mobilization targeting and all that. So when we make, for example, in 2016, we made over 235,000 phone calls in support of Catherine Cortez Masato in Nevada. And that helped push her over the top by giving all of the information directly to the campaign for them to use to mobilize them and get out the vote, which, of course, we helped with as well.
Is Howard Dean at all involved anymore in the organization?
Howard was involved in our founding, of course, and then we did the unprecedented move as a PAC to kick him out so that he could lead a different PAC. Now, during that time when he was in the DNC, we were still engaged with him. And in fact, his brother, Jim Dean, became the chair of our organization. And Jim is still the chair of our organization. He still leads us on the day-to-day and does fantastic work. Governor Dean did come back to us after his stint as the chair of the Democratic National Committee. He worked with us for several years, including running a very successful campaign in support of the healthcare, Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. You know, we parted ways a little bit during the presidential primary. He supported Hillary Clinton and our members supported Bernie Sanders. And after the end of that campaign, we decided that it was time to officially end our direct collaboration. But that said, you know, we still hear from him from time to time. It's not like there isn't a speaking relationship between us. There is. And Jim Dean, of course, will always be Howard's brother.
That's a pretty interesting situation where there's a little bit of a gulf between the organization that came out of his campaign and him. I don't want to make too much of that, but it is a little bit noteworthy.
Yeah, I hear that. You know, I think it's interesting. What we're looking at here is we're looking at an elected leader from 10, 14 years ago that was very, very much ahead of the curve for the Democratic Party establishment. He understood that we needed to be strong and bold in our core democratic values and that we needed to fight for them. He understood that we needed to have a 50-state strategy. We needed to build a farm team of progressive Democrats at the local level if we hope to ever have progressive Democrats run at the national level. You know, he got all that, and that was part of what made him a visionary for the work we did. But at the same time, I don't think it should be terribly surprising that as Governor Dean has gotten older and as all of that has moved forward, that the actual grassroots has moved a little bit away and beyond, has evolved. And I would say that there are ways in which the grassroots is critical, that they're leading this movement forward. We're seeing this really under Trump, and we're seeing that there is a Democratic establishment that's a little slow to grow at the same strength and velocity of the movement itself. So I'm not entirely surprised that we've moved a bit away from Governor Dean, much as we've moved a bit away from some of the old school leaders throughout the party. And we have a constituency that's really embracing the new leadership of people like Pramila Jayapal in the House, or Jeff Merkley, or Elizabeth Warren in the Senate.
It's very interesting. So can you give me a sense of how you understand, like you say, you have more than a million people, members. How do you understand where they sit? Like you said, you know, we polled them about their preference in the 2016 primary, and 159,000 answered. That's not the same as a scientific poll. It's possible that that group of people was reflective of 10 times as many, or it's possible that those were the most energized subset of your group that were excited by Bernie, or a lot of things could have happened in that kind of poll, right? That poll could have been promoted by Bernie people or something. I mean, I think it does make sense that your activist constituency would prefer Bernie, but all those caveats do apply, right?
Absolutely. Although I would say that actually both statements you made are true, which is that they are both representative of the greater membership, on whole. And they're representative of the most active part of our membership. And in fact, we actually encourage our members to push their friends and family and others to sort of get out the vote for a candidate when we do an endorsement poll. But you're right. It's not a scientific poll like the kind of thing you might see from Reuters or Quinnipiac poll. It's the kind of poll where you're actually going to the people that are already active on your list, and you're asking them for their response. And so what we have found over the years when we survey our membership this way, it's how we're able to find out where the real energy is, where the real power is, and it makes it possible for us to see what is coming up much, much better than actual traditional polling does of a broader based constituency. A great example, this is in 2008, it became very clear very early on that Hillary Clinton had a real problem in the primary when we surveyed our membership, and she only got 5% of the vote. In fact, it was Barack Obama, John Edwards, and Dennis Kucinich that split the majority of the votes, well over a supermajority of the votes in that poll. That poll had over 500,000 votes in it. So that was a sign that we had a grassroots constituency that wasn't terribly excited about the Clinton campaign in 2008. And it didn't surprise us at all as we saw power coalesce behind the Obama campaign, because we were seeing it among our membership long before it was showing up in polling, long before anybody in the establishment believed that Hillary Clinton was even vulnerable from an Obama campaign. So I would say that that's part of what makes it so possible for us as an organization to be nimble, to be cutting edge, and to be ahead of the curve over and over again. And it's because we listen to the members that are most active, that are really driving the activism and the work on the ground that elects Democrats, especially progressives.
I think an extraordinarily important part of politics today is sort of that general observation. And my feeling about it is a little bit mixed, which is, in my view, sometimes the most active wing of our party is ahead of the game and is making a choice that is farsighted, ahead of the country. I think in the case of Barack Obama, that's an example of that. All I'm saying is, at least theoretically, you could have a situation where a small percentage of the party gets very excited about a candidate that doesn't well represent the party more broadly and might not be the best person to hold up the standard for half of the country.
So I think that is something that could happen. The reason why it doesn't really happen with DFA, at least when we're talking about a national campaign like presidency, is that we work hard to recruit a diverse membership of people that are interested and engaged in making sure that we win elections. And the reality is that the DFA base, the Democrat, is not actually that much different than the Democratic Party itself. And so because of that, we have pragmatic members that encourage support for more centrist Democrats. We have members that are more extreme that encourage support for extreme left candidates. And it all merges together.
When you come to these conclusions as a group and find candidates across the country that you support, who are the organizations out there in the progressive ecosystem that you find yourself most closely aligned with?
Well, over and over again, what we find our membership is most engaged in is fighting income inequality and defeating structural racism. So what we're really looking at here is we're looking at candidates that are fighting for an inclusive populism that lifts wages, creates great new jobs, that fights against voter suppression and for expanding voter access, and that understands that a critical step forward for the entire country is to expand and improve access to healthcare and education. These are the key parts of the coalition that create inclusive populism, and they're all being driven by the New American Majority, which is the combination of progressives, of people of color, and whites that work together to vote in these states and make sure that we can win on the critical ideals that will move America forward.
So you use the term inclusive populism, and that seems to be a key expression for you. What does that mean?
So inclusive populism is the fight against income inequality with a very critical frame of understanding that that fight is directly tied to the white supremacist society that has overall dominated our globe and our country, that has created structural racism built into every aspect of this country and of our institutions. So whether we're talking about education or healthcare, or we're talking about our court system, or we're talking about our criminal process, or we're talking about rehabilitation or even our social safety net. Over and over again, what we've seen is that we have a system that continually increases income inequality rather than fighting against it, and that is worst felt by people of color across this country. So inclusive populism is the fight to reform it, to make it so that we have an economy that works for everyone. And in doing that, understands that right now it's working a lot worse for people of color than it is for white males like myself.
And so in practice, how does that, for example, affect the criteria that you use for endorsement?
Sure. Well, so we're looking at a lot of different things when we make our decisions on how to endorse. And like I said before, especially as you get to a higher level, direct involvement from our membership, it can be as strong as actually even putting the decision of whether or not to endorse up to our membership. I do want to say when we get down to the offices, even a Senate or a congressional office, but especially when you get lower to offices like school board and city council, while we rely very heavily on what our members think in those districts, we also know that there's significantly less media information put out there. There's significantly less access to all the information. So when we make an endorsement, we do more than just poll our members. We go and we review the campaigns. We review the district and the chances of winning. We review what kind of campaign is being put together. Are they actually targeting black and brown voters and trying to mobilize the Democratic core constituency? Or are they doing like what Ralph Northam did in Virginia this last year and targeting this mythical flippable Republican, white voter, instead of trying really hard to get out the base? We believe that the key to making sure we win is to get out the base. And in fact, Virginia is a great example of that, because the reason we were able to win is because we had an incredibly diverse slate of delegates running up and down the ballot, up and down the state, campaigning, and they increased the vote margin totals by huge numbers. Look at somebody like Danica Rome, the first transgender activist elected to office, or one of the first, and she did this in a district defeating the author of the transgender bathroom ban by increasing the voter turnout among Democrats by over 30%. That kind of increase happened all over the state with us electing our first Vietnamese American, our first two Latina Americans, and our second black man statewide, along with socialists that we elected, and a number of other exciting candidates that all ran as themselves. They ran as true, authentic Democrats. And in every case, they increased the voter turnout for Democrats by double digits. In contrast, you look at Ralph Northam. Ralph Northam only put 4 percentage point increase on Hillary Clinton's numbers for the state. that is an example, in our opinion, of how to run a poor campaign and still win, which is great. We're really glad he won. We wanted him to win. But that was a poor campaign, whereas it's possible he wouldn't even have won if it hadn't been for all these delegate races that actually put in numbers like Danica Rome of 30% increase. So when we're looking at endorsing, we're looking at what is the campaign you're running and how are you running it? And are you going to fight on your values? Are you going to be authentic? Are you fighting for inclusive populism? And are you running the kind of campaign that is targeting the core voters that are actually going to get out and vote and be inspired to talk about your campaign and encourage others to join them?
So I think that the notion that running all those strong candidates across Virginia and the work that they did raise the number of people who voted is very persuasive. But it's also the case that in almost every district that I'm aware of, more people voted on the top of the ticket than did vote down ballot. How do you reconcile those two things?
Sure. Well, look, every campaign brings voters to the polls. And we believe that what happens is that votes trickle up, which is to say that if you came to the polls specifically to vote for a legislative candidate, you're engaged enough that you're going to vote at a ticket entirely up and down the ballot. And in fact, what we find is that you tend to stay within the same ticket. So if you come to vote for a Democratic candidate for school board or for city council or for state ledge, then you are going to vote all the way up the ticket for the senator, for Congress, all of those things within the ticket. So what you're seeing there is you're seeing the extra people that the Northam campaign brought in, because they did. It's not like they didn't run a campaign. They certainly ran a campaign, and there were aspects of the campaign they ran that were fantastic. Just overall, if you look at the difference between the way in which they ran their campaign and the rest of the delegates across the state, you can see why the delegates had an extreme surge in the number of turnout of Democrats in their districts, whereas statewide, we saw only a 4% game overall. And I think there's no question Northam brought in some of that game, and you can see that when you look at those numbers of the people that voted just for him and not for the rest of the ticket. But that's because often when we focus on the top of the ticket, the idea that there's some kind of coattails that trickles down in votes, there's some truth to that, but not enough, as we've seen over and over again in the stats from presidential election to presidential election.
I think that this is an important theory of politics that you're putting forward, and that is shared by a lot of people, particularly on the left. Tell me more about how you understand what constitutes successful campaigning at this point in America.
You bet. The bottom line is that every election is a base election. There are way more voters that don't vote than there are, or at least a pretty equal number of voters that don't vote than there are that do vote. And that number rises when we're in non-presidential elections, because obviously presidential elections get so much press. That's by far the largest voter turnout surge. But it gets worse and worse as you go along. And our argument is that if we actually engage the people that have been disenfranchised, that have decided to stay home, then we can win. Look at the presidential election here. Hillary Clinton, at the end of the day, lost by less than 100,000 votes in three states. And less than 5 million people, or rather around 5 million people that voted for Obama stayed home. If we had gotten even 100,000 of those voters in those key states to vote, then we'd have a different election here. And we have a different outcome, rather, and most importantly, a different president. And so I think one of the lessons that we need to learn when we look at races like this is, well, why did those voters stay home? And we have the answer, because what we have seen over and over again is that voters are looking for Democrats that are standing up and fighting for inclusive populism, standing up and fighting for a vision for America that they understand, rather than just fighting against what Republicans are for, or worse, not even fighting for inclusive populism and fighting for Republican-light policies, which in this day and age means not just Republican-light, but racist-light. And that disenfranchises the core Democratic base that wants to get out and be excited and campaign for these candidates. The bottom line is that you need the advocates on the ground. That's the regular average person. You need them to be going to their friends and family and coworkers and advocating for your candidate. And they just won't do it if they're not inspired. And if they're not inspired and don't do that, then the fall-off voters don't vote. The only people that vote are the most obsessed. And that isn't good enough for winning elections in this day and age.
Do you think that there are districts where the base is not big enough to win?
Well, You know, that's a complicated question to answer. The reason it's complicated, of course, is because of redistricting, where state legislatures are able to redraw the lines of all the different districts. And when they do, they often make those districts have a disproportionate number of people from one party or another in that district. Now, the answer I would give you, though, is that actually inclusive populism, well, it's called populism because it's popular. And when you talk about things like expanding Social Security or raising minimum wage, these are two examples of issues that are not just popular among the Democratic base, but they are also extremely popular among the Republican base. And in actuality, if you poll like Kentucky or Texas, you'll see that expanding Social Security enjoys 60-65% among Republicans as well. So I would argue that even in deep, dark Republican districts, if you run on the core values of the Democratic Party that are included in inclusive populism, then you have a chance to win even in a district that may have a registration majority of Republicans that is over Democrats by 25%. But the other thing to keep in mind is that it's not just about who's registered in a district. It really is about who shows up. And you can have significantly less of the market on paper, but if the people that are actually going out and doing the work and voting are your people, then you can win even with a smaller group of people. So look at what's happening right now. I mean, Alabama was in play even before it was revealed that Roy Moore was a child predator. And now, would we have won? We probably wouldn't have, but we would have come a heck of a lot closer. We would have closed that margin to being a competitive race regardless. And that's because, not just because Doug Jones was fighting on issues that were more democratically popular, but it was also because the Republican voters are depressed, and they're either complacent under Trump because they like what he's doing and think that they don't need to lift a finger to help him, or they're depressed and they're upset about the fact that Trump isn't the candidate they wanted. So they're staying home, where Democrats are like, oh my gosh, Trump is such a disaster. I got to do whatever I can to get involved and try to stop this and put America back on the right track. So I would argue, like, right now we're looking at a wave election for 2018. And the question is going to be, is it going to be a little wave or is it going to be a tsunami? And that's what we're trying to create, is a tsunami, which could mean that we flip districts that Republicans on paper have an advantage of that's insurmountable.
One of the interesting dynamics going on in the election right now nationally is a number of Senate Democrats that are located in states that Trump won handily. And there seems to be an effort in the Senate to protect those particular senators on certain votes that would expose them to what are perceived as unpopular stands in their states, which are red states, like on immigration and so on. Let's take a state like that, like West Virginia, where you really have a pretty conservative Democrat in the Senate, I think has a primary challenge. But tell me, like, what's your theory of how we hold or change or and carry that state for the Senate?
Well, I'm going to sound a little bit like a broken record. The reality is that if Joe Manchin actually went out there and championed inclusive populist policies, if he was out there every day saying we should expand Social Security, we should raise minimum wage, we should make better wages across the board for everyone, you know, make a system that actually takes on the corporations, takes on corporate power, and makes it so that our economy works for everyone, Joe Manchin would be leading in the polls by 20 percentage points, whether he's a Democrat or Republican, because these are the universal philosophies, issues, policies that the American people want to see happen. At the end of the day, they care much less about the party position behind a candidate than they do about the results of what they're fighting for. So I would argue that Joe Manchin would be succeeding at a much higher level if he was actually following our arguments for how to fight as a Democrat rather than listening to the Democratic establishment. I would argue that what the Democratic establishment is doing right now to candidates like Joe Manchin, and honestly, they're also doing this to candidates like Sherrod Brown and Tammy Baldwin, who are great, long-standing progressives with incredible progressive track records. And that is the establishment is telling them to either be quiet and say nothing and let Trump destroy the Republican Party on his own, and hopefully they'll somehow squeak in anyway, or to actually say things supportive of Trump whenever they can, which is what they've been telling Joe Manchin to do. And both of those philosophies are a mistake. What Americans want to see is leaders. They want to see people that actually stand up and really fight. And they don't actually care quite as much as to exactly how much every position of these fighters have. What they care more is whether or not they are authentic in fighting for those positions. They can smell BS. They can often tell when somebody isn't really behind what the issues that they're trying to expose are. And they're looking for people that they feel are authentic and who do this full time that know the job better than them. So that's why you look at a state like Vermont, for example, that elects Bernie Sanders over and over again, and yet also has a Republican governor, elects Republican governors, does that regularly. And those same people vote for both Bernie and the Republican. And they do that because they believe that both of them are authentically fighting for what they believe in. And so that's the key. If Joe Manchin, if Tammy Baldwin, if Sherrod Brown, if the Democrats that are up in these 10 states that Trump won were all fighting authentically for what they really believed in, they would be in a much stronger position to win re-election than if they're doing instead what the Democratic establishment is telling them to do, and that's be quiet and say nothing, or actually say things like, I don't know, Trump's not all bad, which is certainly not helpful for the goal we're trying to get.
I think there's quite a lot of appeal to what you're saying and to what you're urging. I do note that, take Vermont, for example, when a Republican wins statewide in Vermont, like the governorship, they tend to be a Republican, not from the right wing of the Republican Party.
Right. They tend to be more from the libertarian wing. That's true. Mm-hmm.
And that tends to be a tactic or a genuine feeling or combination of them, as it tends to be, that serves them in running in a liberal state like Vermont. Why is it not true also for the reverse to be true, that it's effective for a Democrat to run more as a moderate in a conservative state?
So this is a classic establishment frame that I totally understand where it comes from. And look, I'm not the purveyor of truth. I'm going to bet that in some respects, there are districts and places where this strategy is the better strategy than the one that I'm pushing. But the reality is that the Democratic establishment thinks that their strategy works in every district, everywhere, always. And that is just factually incorrect. And is one of the reasons why we lost over 1,000 seats over the last 10 years. We lost them all over the place because we had an establishment that insisted that the best way for Democrats to win was by being Republican light, which was by running policies that were just a little bit better and a little bit nicer than their opponent, but still stuck with their frame. Well, the reality is that that's led to 90 million people not voting. If you do polling of the general public, or of just voters in general that are registered to vote, you see that on Democratic issue after Democratic issue after Democratic issue, they support our positions. And they support those positions often in the 70 percentile, which in any election, 70 percentile, that's a landslide. Most elections are close. But yet issue after issue that Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders push are the ones that get the super high levels of support. And even among Republicans, often in the high 60s or even the low 70s when you talk about things like expanding Social Security. The point I'm trying to make is, yes, that strategy might make sense in some extremely red districts. Maybe there's a district in Oklahoma which has been trending further and further Republican year after year after year. Maybe there are districts in Oklahoma where it actually would work, or even in West Virginia, districts in West Virginia where it actually does work to play by what the establishment is suggesting. But what we're saying is that in any statewide contest and in any race that is truly competitive, Democrats do better by fighting for what we believe in. Fighting for the actual issues of and positions that we stand by and that are the core values of the party, than when we try to be Republican light, or in this day and age, that means racist light, which just depresses our base and keeps our base from actually advocating for our candidates and spreading the wealth, slash maybe not even going to the polls themselves.
You know, I think we are generally in agreement on that. And I've seen a number of very talented politicians run and vote as progressives in, you know, like Western states that go heavily Republican in the presidential race. And a lot of it does depend on their candidate skills and their ability to frame progressive issues in a way that resonates with the audience that they have.
Yeah, I think that's right. So I agree with what you just said, but I would definitely say that the key component that is often lost by politicians that is true over and over again is authenticity. You can have pretty whacked out views on either direction. And if people believe that you really believe those positions and that you're willing to fight for them, the general American public is accepting. They believe in people. They feel like, look, my daytime job is to be a doctor or a janitor or a lawyer or a teacher or whatever they're doing during the day. And that they understand that elected leaders' daytime job is to actually understand these issues and fight for them. And so if you've got somebody who's being authentic about what they're fighting for, that right away gives people a real bump when running for office. Because the average person is like, well, you probably know better than me. So I may have this general opinion, but I, you know, hearing you make a compelling argument for this, I'm willing to give it a risk. And so it's interesting to see how the Republicans take advantage of that very well. And they often fight for the most extreme positions when they're campaigning. And then they lead or they govern from a completely different position when they're actually elected. Whereas Democrats often, they fight for the exact same level of compromise and sausage making that goes into actually making bills, both during the campaign as they do once they're elected. And the reality is that the American public is not as excited by that. They're not as driven by that. But also it makes it sound like the politician isn't as authentic because it sounds like they're not as passionate and driven to get their goals across. And I think that really hurts us over and over again.
I mean, I think we all appreciate in anybody that we interact with, politician or not, a sense that they truly believe in what they're saying and that they're authentic. There's something sometimes, though, that makes me wonder if it's in politics, it's exactly authenticity always. Like people will say, have said to me that Trump is authentic, but I don't see their candidate was saying what he believed in. I have no earthly idea what he actually believes in. There's a few prejudices that I'm persuaded that he has. But if you look back through his history, he's been on every side of every issue. But more than anything, is almost ignorant about the details of any issue. But yet people perceived an authenticity just because he was willing to say stupid things all the time.
Yeah. We're taking sort of an extreme example, but that I think I can actually, if you go with me for a moment, I think I can have this make my point. I would argue that Trump is actually authentic in regards to the respect that everybody knows he's a liar. There's no fakeness there. I mean, nobody thinks that what Trump is saying is the truth, and I don't believe that his supporters believe it either. In fact, I would argue that often his most extreme rhetoric, they listen to that extreme rhetoric and they're like, ah, finally, somebody's saying what I really think. And that's the authenticity and that's what they're talking about. They're not talking about the overall gamut of everything that Trump says. They know that he flip-flops. They know that he lies and he goes back and forth. But the key thing is that on a core basis, just as you just said a moment ago, they know where he stands on some critical issues that are important to them, you know, about making America white again, for example, is a critical goal. They get that. No matter what he says, that's what he's really trying to do because that's come across over and over again. So when they say he's authentic, that's what they mean. And I hate putting these two people in the same paragraph, but I would argue that on our side, we had a lot of that truth with Bill Clinton as well. You know, Bill Clinton came across as a car salesman often, which meant that people said, look, I think he's probably lying to me a bunch, but I like the core values and I don't mind the fact that it feels like, you know, when he says he's against marriage equality, I really think he's for it. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink. I know that's true. And so therefore, they actually don't feel it's inauthentic when he came out there and said, I'm against marriage equality. Well, the same token, that's what's happening with Trump. So these are, though, are I say, extreme examples. And certainly, I think Bill Clinton has a ton more integrity than Donald Trump has ever had. But those are extreme examples, whereas in most elections and most candidates, you get much less extreme versions of it.
Do you think that sometimes people pretend to be progressives in an inauthentic way? Like, it occurs to me, like, one example of that would be, like, and I might be wrong about this, but it felt like when John Edwards ran for president, that he ran way to the left of where he had been as a senator. And I, for one, just didn't really buy it.
Yeah, you know, well, I mean, obviously, it turns out that John Edwards was full of all sorts of deception, including covering up that he had an extramarital affair that resulted in a baby. So this is somebody who is an expert at sort of fooling people with his authenticity. I think it's really interesting because I was certainly taken by that. I was surprised and very, very upset with John Edwards. Can you even imagine that now if in the Me Too era, what would happen if that kind of scenario was, it's just, I mean, thank heavens John Edwards is forever out of politics.
At the same time, we have Trump getting away with everything, right? And so
well, that's a really great point.
I mean, we have a very peculiar thing happening with our politics where Al Franken can't get away with some misbehavior, but Trump can.
And Trump's behavior is arguably criminal. And Al Franken, what he was accused of was super lecherous, gross, and disgusting, but certainly not criminal either. And that dichotomy is hard to reckon with. And I do think that comes down to, on some level, this issue of, well, I mean, Trump is a special anomaly in a couple different ways, but not the least of which being his direct and clear embracing of racism in a way that I think is really brought out the last gasp of white Americans to try to retain power that they're ultimately losing as we move forward. The reality is that every single demographic of white people voted for Donald Trump. And that's something that we really need to be thinking about as we move ahead and thinking about what direction do we want to be leading this country, which is one of the key reasons why Democracy for America is so focused on the new American majority, because the reality is that the future of the Democratic Party and the future of America is all going to be led by people. White people in this country play an extremely important, absolutely critical role in who we're going to elect and what kind of policies we're going to have on the America we're going to live in. But the reality is that as we look forward to the future in 2018, 2020, 2024, 2028, as we go ahead and on, we're going to see more and more people of color moving up into leadership in America. And it's going to be time for white people to recognize that we're going to need to be following that lead, especially if you want to build a more progressive and stronger America that fights for inclusive populism that brings everybody to the top.
Back a minute or two in our discussion, you kind of made this distinction between the movement and the establishment. And it's my own view that we need both in order to win. What's your take on that?
We definitely need both in order to win. The problem is that right now the establishment still controls all the levers to success and power, and then it definitely makes the hurdles for the grassroots a lot stronger, a lot harder. Yet it's really interesting to see if you look at, for example, the last primary. I mean, even with that being said, Bernie Sanders won 23 contests. That's nothing to scoff at. It's important to recognize that even with all the ways in which the establishment fought against that and tried to choose their handpicked candidate, the actual grassroots still had a huge amount of power. But what we do see there is we see that because the two didn't work together well after the primary, did that movement really come together in a way to try to defeat Trump? And obviously, we didn't succeed in defeating Trump. And even while a larger number of Bernie supporters ended up voting for Hillary Clinton than Hillary Clinton supporters ended up voting for Barack Obama back in 2008, the reality is that because the Clinton campaign wasn't able to bridge the gap with the huge surge of voters that Bernie had brought in and hadn't connected back to the Obama voters that had voted before, we had 5 million Obama voters that stayed home and we didn't win. So I definitely agree with you. The best combo is a combo of the grassroots and the establishment working together. That's when we succeed. That's the most likely time we're going to win. But I would argue that either side can defeat the other in specific elections if the resources are right. And that's why establishment beats the grassroots over and over again, even when the energy is really on the grassroots, because they've got those tools of power controlling things like voter files, campaign staff, major donor fundraising, all that kind of thing.
What are you, speaking for your organization, what are you most excited about as you look forward to 2018?
Well, I'll tell you, if there's a single race I want to point out to everybody that's listening to this, that everybody should be watching, it's the Georgia governor race. Stacey Abrams is an incredible transformative leader. This woman, when Georgia elects her, as she moves forward, she could be president someday. The first stop is to win Georgia's governorship and turn Georgia blue. She can do it. She spent the last 2 years registering over 200,000 new voters, especially among Black and brown communities within Georgia. She's done an incredible job of leadership from within the state legislature. She's running a campaign that connects and that people understand, going to every community around the state already and engaging people. You know, I was at a kickoff event in Georgia, in Mason, which is a small town in southeast Georgia. And the security guard at the event I was talking to says, you know, I'm a Republican. And he leans into me and he goes, you'd probably call me a right-wing crazy. And I can't imagine that I would ever vote for a black woman for governor. But I'll tell you what, I'm really impressed that she even came to our city, that she's engaging with us directly. And having just heard her speak, he said, I think I'm going to vote for her. So that's a pretty remarkable scenario, except for it's not when you meet Stacey and you see the campaign she's running. So she's fantastic. I really want to point all eyes on her and say, support her, help make sure she wins. Because to win that race, we need to be fighting every day from now to the election. That means she's going to need lots of resources to make it happen.
Does she have a competitive primary? I haven't followed that closely.
She does have a primary. I'm not confident as to how competitive it actually is. The Democratic establishment there, unfortunately, did recruit a woman by the name of Stacey Evans to run, which is super confusing to have two Stacey's on the ballot. The basic premise of the Democratic establishment in Georgia is that a black woman can't win statewide. And so they recruited a white woman into the race. That would be my argument for why she was recruited. I think that she has been running a not very good campaign so far. And so I'm not at all sure that it's actually a competitive primary. But don't get me wrong, we're not taking it laying down. Everybody who's a supporter of Stacey Abrams, we're fighting hard to make sure that we win that primary and make sure that we go into the general election with a strong, unified Democratic Party fighting behind Stacey Abrams.
I mean, governor's races are so crucial coming up, especially in states like Georgia. Are there other states where you have candidates that you're really excited about?
Yeah, definitely. Very excited about Andrew Gillum in Florida, who's running against a very centrist Democrat in the primary, Gwen Graham. Basically, he's never met a Republican bill she didn't support. And so it's exciting to have somebody, the mayor of Tallahassee, who's a fantastic, inclusive populist, who has a track record of fighting for and winning on progressive issues. He is tied in the polls with Gwen Graham. He's slightly behind on fundraising. So if you're listening to this conversation and you like the idea of supporting an inclusive populist in Florida who can really deliver, then please consider contributing to his campaign. On top of that, I'd say we've got David Garcia in Arizona running for governor there, another fantastic candidate. In Maryland, we have Ben Jealous, who's the former head of the NAACP and who was a big-time Bernie supporter campaigning for him across the country. That's another transformative race that we could win and help make sure that we move Maryland back to the blue column in the governor's seat and do it with somebody who's a true, authentic progressive in the role.
What's your take on the Michigan governor's race?
That's exciting how that's playing out. So far, we have not made an endorsement in that race. There's a number of candidates that are compelling. We've supported Gretchen in the past, but I don't know if we're going to end up supporting her this time or not. It's going to really depend on what our members want put together with what we see as we continue to see how they build these campaigns and what they're doing to try to fight to win. So I think it's an exciting race that we have not made taken a position on yet.
Anything else you'd like to tell me about Democracy for America or what you guys are up to?
Sure. I guess what I would do is I would make a pitch to anybody listening that if you're not familiar with Democracy for America, go to our website, democracyforamerica.com. Look over the work we do, our track record, our history. We have information about our history, our 14-year history, some highlights you can look at. You can look at the candidates we're supporting right now and see that we're really fighting for the real progressives and fighting to make sure we win. You know, we don't just support any Democrat just because they have a D behind their name. We want to make sure that we're supporting true progressives that are fighting hard to move America forward, because not every Democrat is. The reality is that sometimes some of the worst of the things that happen in America don't just happen with the entire Republican Party. It needs to happen because a few bad Democrats support that. And so we're trying to replace the bad Democrats with great Democrats where we can. But most importantly, across the board, we're trying to defeat Republicans that are taking America backwards so that we can move America forward and have an economy that works for everybody, so that we can take on white supremacy and defeat structural racism, reform it so that we have a system that doesn't hold people back based on the color of their skin.
Charles, been lovely to talk to you. Anything else you want to say?
I thank you so much for having me on. It's always great to have a deep conversation. So often conversations with reporters get, you know, down to the sound bites and not able to get into the weeds and have real discussions about overall philosophy. I love being able to have the discussion of philosophy. And, you know, I'm eager to continue that conversation. You know, we're not the purveyors of all things that are true. I'm sure some of the things that I said today were wrong. But I am confident that across the board, what we stand for, what we're fighting for, and the way we're doing it is the best way that we've got out there right now. And I encourage everyone listening to join our work, fight with us. And when you think that we're not doing things right, we're a member-driven organization, reach out to us. There's so many ways you can reach us through our website, through Facebook, through Twitter, through phone calls. You can literally call us directly. Please do tell us what you think we're doing right, what we're doing wrong, so that we can continue to represent progressives nationwide the best we possibly can.
Well, I'm very glad you're out there doing what you're doing, and I appreciate your work.
Awesome. Thank you, and right back at you.
So that was Charles and Democracy for America, or DFA. Charles is at democracyforamerica.com. With more than 1 million members, DFA is a key part of the progressive infrastructure. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with a Great Battlefield podcast. You can find us at resistancedashboard.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.